Big event, of course, was the New York court result. And quite frankly, that's unprecedented. When Nixon got run out of town, he was pardoned by Gerald Ford immediately. You remember when, for example, Hillary Clinton was caught with a server and so forth in her basement, she was not prosecuted. This is the first time where the ruling party has used the courts in this way. And one of the things about it is, in order to use that court this way, the court itself has to be corrupted. So it isn't just the people who set this up that are a problem. The judge had to be corrupted, the prosecutor had to be corrupted, and they had to corrupt 12 citizens. So what I want to talk about is two things: how we got there and what our besetting sin is. I was listening to Ron Dart on Friday, and he had a very nice summary that applies to where we are, and I'll get to that in just a minute. And then Doug Wilson had an interesting article. What he says, and I agree with him completely, is our besetting sin is envy, or greed, or covetousness, or however you want to describe it. That's the thing that drives everything in the United States right now. And he quoted from a book by a guy named George Gilder. I haven't read that book, but I'm familiar with him, talking about the value of things. And what he says is the only commodity that cannot be inflated is time. Every other commodity can be inflated. You know, you can print lots of money, you can clip gold coins, you can do all sorts of things to inflate, and that's all been done, but time you can't. And the example he gave, and I'll read this to you from his article, in his 1994 essay, "Do Real Income and Real Wage Measures Capture Reality? The History of Lighting," for the National Bureau of Economic Research, Nordhaus concluded, one modern 100-watt incandescent bulb — this was obviously several years ago, because you can't buy those anymore — the symbol of American inventiveness is gone. You know, the light bulb used to be the symbol of American inventiveness. Anyway, one modern 100-watt incandescent bulb burning for 3 hours each night would produce 1.5 million lumens of light per year. Letting you know that turn on a 100-watt light bulb and you leave it run for 3 hours at night, over a year, you will generate 1.5 million lumens of light. At the beginning of 1800, obtaining that amount of light would have required burning 17,000 candles. The average worker would have had to toil almost 1,000 hours to earn the money to buy the candles. So, in order to generate the amount of light at the end of the 19th century, you would have had to work 1,000 hours to buy 17,000 candles to generate that much light. In the modern era, with the compact fluorescent bulb, the 1.5 million lumen hours would need 22 kilowatt hours. That can be bought for about 10 minutes work by the average worker. The whole point that Wilson is making here is, as we look around, compared to the rest of the world, we are in the top 1%. Compared to all history, we are in the top 0.0001%. And all we do is whine. Instead of looking up, we're looking around. The fact that you can, for what, 5 minutes labor, burn a 100-watt light bulb all night. By the way, reading by a 100-watt light bulb is a whole lot better than reading by a candle. So the quality of the light is better. But instead of being grateful, we whine. Well, that guy's got a really big house, and he has lights on all night. I mean, look at all the light he's using. I have a 21-year-old Ford Escape car. I love that car. It's been a very faithful car. It still runs really well. I see absolutely no reason to get rid of it. Nebuchadnezzar could not have given half of his kingdom for that car. It wasn't available. Now, I don't crave a BMW. I just don't care about those things, but that's personal with me. But I can see that somebody who had my 21-year-old Ford Escape would look at somebody with a BMW and, and that's what we are. Furthermore, put one from Doug Wilson, which I thought was really funny. Jeremy Carl points out in his timely new book, The Unprotected Class, that the years between 2010 and 2020, our Native American population exploded from 5.3 million to 9.7 million. You know what that is, of course. That's people claiming to be Native Americans so they can get into the victim parade. That's what Elizabeth Warren did. Got herself into Harvard as a teacher by claiming to be a Native American. In other words, the number of Native Americans didn't double during 10 years. It's people being greedy, claiming to be something they weren't, so that they could get some kind of an advantage over somebody else. So Wilson's whole point here is our besetting sin in the United States right now is greed, or covetousness, or envy, however you want to describe it. Now, how we get there? That's where Ron Dart comes in. What Ron was talking about, interestingly enough, is God's appointed times, the Sabbaths, the festivals, etc. And one of the things that you'll notice in today's Torah reading is the thing that sets God off is when you walk contrary to me, and it says that over and over again, the word there in Hebrew means if you treat me casually, which is to say, if you don't look at me as God, but you just say all of the blessings that I have gotten just sort of happen. I worked hard for them and so forth, or whatever, and you sort of forget about God. This cascade of things that God says will happen, which did happen, by the way, this cascade then starts with treating God casually, not being aware of God fairly constantly. And Ron's point here was God has set up in the week and in the year appointed times to bring everybody back to him. So we're sitting here on his Sabbath, and we are thinking about God. I'm talking about God. We're having feasts at the appointed times. And during those times, we're expected to get together and we're expected to celebrate in the presence of God. The whole deal there is you set up your society so that you are consistently and constantly reminded of your relationship to God and are moved to gratitude for what God has done for you. God set that up. Now, our problem is we quit doing that. From the founding of the country, they had the wrong day, but you had Sunday Blue Laws where you couldn't do anything. Everybody had to go to church. You rested on Sunday. And as I say, it's the wrong day, but the attitude is correct. Well, we had prayer in public events to include schools and so forth. The first act of the Congress after the United States was formed was to appropriate money to buy Bibles to be used in the public schools for the instruction of the young. That is the first law that the Congress passed. When Congress came into being, they appropriated money to buy Bibles for all the schools. So what happened? Well, 1962, we started a series of court decisions which said, you can't pray in schools. That's establishment of religion. The churches went along with it. Then in 69, they adjusted the tax code to get the church out of politics. If you want a tax exemption, you cannot talk about partisan things in your church. And the mainline churches were, okay. And then we have a systematic assault on the Ten Commandments. Let me read to you what God says in his Torah. I'm in Deuteronomy 6. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. The Shema, right? And these words that I command you today shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children in the schools. You shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, and when you rise. In other words, you're supposed to be constantly mindful of God. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes. You shall write them on the doorpost of your house and on your gates. On your gates is Bible speak for at the courthouse. So the whole idea of having the Ten Commandments at the courthouse or the town square is what's commanded here in Deuteronomy. And the churches, instead of pitching a world-class hissy fit, we can't impose that on other people. There's a Hebrew word for that, it's called baloney. I really don't care that some atheist is offended or some Muslim is offended by the fact that he comes into my country and sees the word of my God. I really don't care. However, where we are now, I hesitate to say this because it just makes me sad. And I thought it was the Babylon Bee, but it's not. For those of you who know the symbol of the Episcopal Church, it's the cross of St. Andrew, I believe. I don't remember, one of the saints. Anyway, it's a shield with a cross with blue on top and stars. That's the symbol of the Episcopal Church. This month, it has got multicolored stripes across it. It has got rainbow colors in there, and that's now the symbol of the Episcopal Church during Pride Month. So, what Ron Dart was saying is Israel split into two parts, Northern and Southern Kingdom. The Southern Kingdom lasted 125 or so years longer than the Northern Kingdom did. And the reason for that is the first thing Jeroboam did is he said, if people keep going back to Jerusalem for the feasts, pretty soon they're going to all want to go back and we're going to reunite and they're going to kill me. So what he did is he abolished all of God's holy days and said, you don't have to go down to Jerusalem for those. We can do it here. You don't have to teach your kids in school. You can do it at home. Remember that argument? And what happened was there was periodic revival in the Southern Kingdom because they would rediscover the Torah. They had the temple there. They still had the holidays they were serving, and you'd have these big revivals. Hezekiah, for example, never happened in the Northern Kingdom. They never had a revival. And so they got up to their hips in Assyrians, and they have disappeared because they did not keep God at the forefront of their consciousness. And what God's laws and what God's times are designed to do is to remind you of Him. Structure your life, structure your society, structure everything that you have around you to remind you of God. And what that does is it gives you an opportunity, not a guarantee, but an opportunity to give Him thanks for what you have. I get in my little 21-year-old car, and I just sort of smile and I say, God, thank you for giving me such a faithful little car. Because it got a 6-cylinder engine. It's peppier than my wife's brand new car. It is just a nice little car. And I thank God every time I get in it that it is such a faithful little car. And I do that consciously. And the whole point here is all of that is an antidote to covetousness and envy. Being here together is an antidote to covetousness and envy. And what Ron Dart is saying is that when the churches allowed Christianity to be purged from the public square on the idea that, well, you can go to church on Sunday and do anything you want, and you can teach your kids at home anything you want. And what wound up happening is societally, Christianity has been purged. And we have become a post-Christian nation, and everybody is angry and grumpy at everybody else, and covetousness or envy is become our besetting sin, because we do not have churches routinely reminding us to be grateful. And by the way, Judah finally did go into exile. So it isn't foolproof, but it's better than what we're doing, and it was better than what the Northern Kingdom was doing. The thing that is interesting here, Jeremiah 50, "My people have been lost sheep. Their shepherds have led them astray. Turning away on the mountain, from mountain to hill they have gone. They have forgotten their fold. All who found them have devoured them, and their enemies have said, 'We're not guilty,' for they have sinned against the Lord, their habitation of righteousness, the Lord, the hope of their fathers." So over and over again in the prophets, God starts with the priests and the religious leaders. You guys have dropped the ball, and because you have dropped the ball, everybody else is wandering around like a bunch of lost sheep. Hence, they have become prey. And quite frankly, that's where we are today. In Matthew 12, verse 18, the end of the gospel reading today, "Behold, my servant whom I have chosen, my beloved with whom my soul is well pleased, I will put my spirit upon him, and he will proclaim justice to the Gentiles. He will not quarrel or cry aloud, nor will anyone hear his voice in the streets. A bruised reed he will not break, and a smoldering wick he will not quench." In other words, he'll be gentle. Until, oh, wait a minute. He'll be gentle until he brings justice to victory. In his name, the Gentiles will hope. So in his first incarnation, he was gentle. He did not break a bruised reed. Well, he did raise his voice. I mean, he ran through the temple with a whip cord, but mostly he was pretty gentle. But when he's coming back, the big deal is going to be justice. And where we are now, with our besetting sin of envy, we look at justice as a plaything to be used to get our own way. That's what's going on right now in all the lawfare that's going on, where you have grandmothers who happen to walk through the Capitol on January 6th getting thrown in jail for 10 years. You have peaceful ladies who are out in front of an abortion clinic praying are being persecuted according to this Access Act, whatever, and they're getting thrown in jail. The point is that justice no longer exists. It is now the plaything of the powerful. Let's go back to Isaiah, which describes us. And I'm in Isaiah 59. "Behold, the Lord's hand is not shortened that he cannot see, or his ear dull that he cannot hear. But your iniquities have made a separation between you and your God, and your sins have hidden his face so that he does not hear." In other words, he's quit listening to you. "For your hands are defiled with blood, your fingers with iniquity. Your lips have spoken lies, your tongue mutters wickedness. No one enters suit justly. No one goes to law honestly. They rely on empty pleas. They speak lies. They conceive mischief and give birth to iniquity." That sound familiar? "They hatch adder's eggs. They weave spider's webs. He who eats their eggs dies. And from the one that is crushed, a viper is hatched. Their webs will not serve as clothing. Men will not cover themselves with what they make." And what that is saying is, these lies that are being spun are like spider webs. They are insubstantial and they won't keep you warm. That's what he's talking about. "Their webs will not serve as clothing. Men will not cover themselves as what they make. Their works are works of iniquity, and deeds of violence are in their hands. Their feet run to evil, and they are swift to shed innocent blood. Their thoughts are thoughts of iniquity. Desolation and destruction are in their highways. The way of peace they do not know. There is no justice in their paths. They have made their roads crooked. No one who treads on them knows peace. Therefore, justice is far from us. You notice the emphasis here. Keep talking about justice. And righteousness does not overtake us. We hope for light and behold darkness, and for brightness, but we walk in gloom. We grope for the walls like the blind. We grope like those who have no eyes. We stumble at noon as in the twilight. Among those in full vigor, we are like dead men. In other words, as you go away from God, you lose your orientation. You got nothing solid under your feet. So you're walking around like a blind person trying to orient himself in the room by grabbing the walls. We all growl like bears. We moan and groan like doves. We hope for justice, but there is none. For salvation, but it is far from us. For our transgressions are multiplied before you. Our sins testify against us. For our transgressions are with us, and we know our iniquities. Transgressing and denying the Lord and turning back from following our God, speaking oppression and revolt, conceiving and uttering from the heart lying words. So having turned away from God, what we have left are lies. Justice is turned back, and righteousness stands far away. For truth has stumbled in the public square, and uprightness cannot enter. Truth is lacking, and he who departs from evil makes himself a prey. What that is saying is somebody who tries to do good in this environment becomes prey for those who use the justice system and power wickedly. Which is why so many people run to stay with the crowd, because they're afraid. The whole point is, once evil gets going, as it is now, it is very hard to eradicate. And at some point, God says, okay, Babylonian time, or whatever it is, because you can't be corrected. Now, there is a solution to this. And the solution is repentance. The solution is prayer. The solution is turning to righteousness and speaking righteousness boldly. The solution is not playing in this muddy pool. Stay out of the mud. Walk uprightly. And understand that, like those poor ladies who were trying to do that in an abortion clinic, you may suffer for it. It may happen. Because as Jeremiah says, those who try and do righteously have become prey. And that's what's going on with the people who are persecuted for their stand in front of an abortion clinic. So this is not without cost. This is not safe. But it's the only option we have. The other option is continue until we're up to our hips in Chinese or Babylonians or Salvadorian gangs or whatever we happen to be up to our hips in. That's the alternative. I'm not saying you look to be a martyr. Choose life. What I am saying is do right, but understand that there may be a cost.